KBOO has two open board seats and would like to conduct interviews with interested candidates. Those with skills in finance, nonprofit operations, and strategic planning are particularly encouraged to apply. Please call 503-516-3882 and leave a brief message with a phone number or email address at which you may be contacted. The deadline for applications is Monday, April 13th. Interviews will be conducted during the April 20th board meeting, which begins at 6 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle is now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer run, community powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear an update on the sea lion controversy at the Bonneville Dam. Portlanders protest the annual dinner of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in Portland, and national news agencies ignore reports about a secret assassination ring led by former Vice President Dick Cheney.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 30, 2009. I'm Eddie Greenlee.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee held its annual Oregon dinner last night, honoring politicians and business leaders who support the group's agenda. Governor Kulongoski was in attendance, as well as a number of other political leaders from the state. The attendees had to make their way through a protest line of over 100 people holding signs and chanting slogans against the Israel occupation of Palestine. The protesters challenged the $7 million a day given by the U.S. government to Israel. Here are some of the sounds of the protest.
Stop the killing! Stop the death! Stop gay cats! Stop the killing! Stop the death! Stop gay cats!
I think there's a lot of support out here, a lot more than some of us thought we were going to get. There's been a lot of vocal, audible support, people honking their horns. Public opinion has really changed, and there's no question about what's been happening now. It's just really disheartening that it had to come to something like that for people to wake up. And you have a lot of people coming out here today that show, I think, a lot of courage, because so many people are afraid to be labeled anti-Semitic. You know, that has nothing to do with it. What's important is that we're against the policies of the Israeli government.
And yesterday's APEC protest, there was one arrest when 76-year-old veteran Joe Walsh tried to walk along a section of public sidewalk that police had closed off. Pulling his oxygen tank behind him, the lone vet, as he called himself, was grabbed by several police officers and charged with obstruction of an officer.
In a quest to attract solar manufacturing jobs to the region, the Gresham City Hall will host a Green Economic Summit this coming Friday. The city has worked in recent months to prepare for over 200 acres of industrial land to be ready for a potential solar manufacturing plant. The mayor of Gresham says that while the city has taken the right steps toward making connections in solar industry circles, the economic downturn has slowed the process. The mayor is marketing the city of Gresham as an ideal place for so-called green-collar jobs due to the city's property tax incentives, state tax credits, and the city's proximity to the Portland International Airport and to the Port of Portland.
Despite wind and rain, organizers of the Great Oregon Spring Beach Cleanup say that more than 4,000 volunteers turned out for the Saturday event. The Daily Astorian newspaper reports that they raked in a variety of items, including 4 boat refrigerators, a 300-pound freezer, and 20 feet of cattle fencing. In all, an estimated 60,000 pounds of trash were removed from the Oregon coastline. The Saturday event is one of the two beach cleanups organized each year by SOLVE and the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department.
Tidewater Contractors of Brookings, Oregon, has proposed mining rock and gravel from the Elk River near Port Orford. In an application submitted to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the company says it would dredge 12,000 cubic yards of material annually for 5 years. The World newspaper of Coos Bay reports that rock and gravel would be pulled from gravel bars along a mile-and-a-half stretch of the river. The gravel would then be used for road construction projects. The Army Corps is taking public comment on the proposed project until April 26.
The Oregon Department of Forestry is selling off its only tree nursery. A department spokesman said today that declining logging on national forests and increased availability of seedlings from private nurseries forced it to close last year. D.L. Phillips Forest Nursery opened over 40 years ago near Elkton, Oregon, and at its peak produced 16 million seedlings a year. The price for the nursery will be $2 million for over 100 acres, most of it irrigated. An auction was held last January, but none of the bids met minimum specifications.
Controversy continues to surround the state of Oregon's recent decision to allow the killing of sea lions at the Bonneville Dam. Oregon state officials and the fishing industry say it's necessary to kill the sea lions in order to protect the salmon. In the meantime, there has been misinformation in the media. One person even claimed the salmon season had been called off in the area. KBOO's Jeff Watland spoke with Sharon Young of the Humane Society to sort through the confusion.
Sea lions are being slaughtered at the Bonneville Dam to accommodate the fishing industry. There seems to be confusion from some KBOO listeners that the salmon season has been called off in Oregon. Can you verify that one way or the other?
As far as I'm aware, fishing for salmon is ongoing in the Columbia River. There have been closures off of California and southern Oregon to protect salmon that are spawning in the Sacramento and Klamath rivers during the ocean portion of their existence, but that doesn't affect recreational fishing.
Okay, so how has the media been spinning this issue?
I think they're maintaining that same line that, you know, these fish are endangered and the sea lions are eating them and we have to get rid of sea lions if we want to protect the fish. They sometimes point out that they have to throw back the fish that are wild run endangered species, the ones that don't have their fins clipped. But they neglect to mention that a number of those fish die when they're thrown back, and that for that reason, they too have a quota on mortality resulting from fishing on those endangered species, and that that quota, which this year is about 13%, is over twice what the sea lions are eating.
Are there any other repercussions from the killing of these sea lions that are being overlooked?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the killing the sea lions is not going to save the fish. The government itself, I think, has acknowledged that they can't reliably predict a reduction in predation from killing them. And I think that what it really is doing is completely distracting attention from issues that are not being addressed that would actually do something to recover the fish. For example, just this month, there was a report issued by the National Marine Fisheries Service stating that the stocking of non-indigenous fish in the river, such as bass and walleye and carp, those fish are competing with the salmon for habitat and that they eat juvenile salmon. And so, according to this report, that threat, which is completely unaddressed by the government, is actually probably a greater threat to the salmon than some of the habitat issues that are facing them. And the report also stated that the government was reluctant to address it because they're favored targets of recreational fishermen, and they really don't want to, in the words of an article that was in an industry trade publication, the government said they didn't want to, quote, take on, unquote, the recreational fisheries. So I think shooting salmon makes it look like you're doing something to help the fish, when in fact it's not doing anything. It's simply taking away resources, both money and attention, from addressing meaningful problems facing the fish.
You said shooting salmon. Did you mean shooting sea lions?
I meant shooting sea lions. I'm so sorry.
Is there anything else that we need to address here?
Well, I mean, I think it's unfortunate, too, that the government is not allowing the media to cover what they're doing at Bonneville Dam. You know, I've certainly had calls from other reporters asking if I knew why they were not being allowed to go to the dam and you know, see the sea lions being trapped and watch their transfer and things of that sort. It's unfortunate that the states are putting out whatever message they want but not allowing the press or citizens access to see the actual program in effect.
I thank you very much for this interview. I've been speaking with Sharon Young, Marine Issues Field Director for the Humane Society of the United States. With the KBOO Evening News, this is Jeff Watland reporting.
On June 1st, 2009, passports may be required for all people crossing U.S. and Canadian borders. Native Americans living in the northern parts of the United States don't believe they should be forced to comply with the new regulations. The National Congress of American Indians is concerned that tribal governments don't have enough time to create new ID cards that will comply with the federal system. Tribal governments are also hesitant to use their meager funds to pay for the expensive new ID cards. Some tribal leaders have argued that natives who regularly cross the border have every right to do so without complying with a U.S. government policy. In 1794, the Jay Treaty guaranteed indigenous people along the nation's northern border the right to move back and forth between the U.S. and Canada. State governments in the U.S. have been given millions of federal dollars to create special ID cards that comply with the Western Hemisphere's Travel Initiative and the Real ID Act. Tribal governments have not received any money to help them comply with the federally imposed mandate.
Today, President Barack Obama signed into law the Wilderness Protection Act. That sets aside more than 2 million acres as protected wilderness. The president said the new law is among the most important in decades, adding that wilderness areas require wise stewardship. The land protected includes California's Sierra Nevada, Oregon's Mount Hood, Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, and parts of the Jefferson National Forest in Virginia. The law represents one of the largest expansions of wilderness protection in a quarter century. It will give the areas the highest level of government protection.
The nation's biggest drugstore chain is cutting the number of stores where Medicaid prescriptions will be filled in Washington state. According to a statement issued today, Walgreens will stop filling Medicaid prescriptions at 44 of its 111 stores in the state starting May 1st. The announcement cites a new reimbursement rule that reduces payments by the state for name-brand medication and takes effect April 1st. A spokesman for the governor's office said the state is working with other pharmacies to fill the gap Walgreens will create.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invasion in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio at 6. Tomorrow's weather looks like we're going to have some showers, a little cloudy with a high near 52, with west-southwest winds between 9 and 13 miles an hour, gusts as high as 21 miles an hour. Chance of precipitation is 70%.
And the current time is 5:15. And now, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The former geniuses who crashed Wall Street are now pushing a line to excuse them from any and all responsibility. It was a tsunami, they explain. Yes, a once-in-a-lifetime system-wide collapse that no one could have foreseen. Not bankers, not Washington, not the media, not the Weather Channel. No one. It was the thing that came from nowhere, say wide-eyed Wall Street chieftains. For example, Dick Fold, former honcho of Lehman Brothers, says, "I wake up every single night thinking, what could I have done differently?" His answer? Nothing. Bovine excrement. First of all, these guys were paid to know. Mr. Fold, for instance, was considered so knowledgeable about the financial system that he was paid $350 million by Lehman in the 5 years before, poof, his policies imploded the bank. Banksters like him literally invented the scam that created the tsunami, namely the flim-flam of global trading and computerized bets, irredeemable promises, puffs of air, and other figments of financial imagination. Second, they are the ones who dispersed campaign cash and deployed an army of lobbyists to get Washington to create the, quote, dark market that allowed them to play their get-rich-quick casino games without public scrutiny, much less regulation. Indeed, a group called Wall Street Watch has just issued a report showing that in the past decade, the finance industry donated $1.7 billion to Washington politicians and spent $3.4 billion on lobbyists. They had 3,000 of them on the industry payroll in 2007 alone. In return, Washington gave a dozen specific deregulatory rule changes to Wall Street that led directly to today's financial meltdown. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see the report, go to wallstreetwatch.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
After being dismissed for lack of evidence 36 years ago, prosecutors are pursuing a murder case against the Black Panthers. Claiming to have new evidence, the prosecution has rearrested former suspects and put them up for trial. This new evidence appears to be nothing more than illegal testimony that was gathered under torture. KBOO's Jeff Watland spoke with Claude Marks of the San Francisco 8 Defense Committee to find out more.
This was a cold case for 36 years. Can you give us some background on why it's being prosecuted now?
1973, 13 Panthers are arrested in New Orleans. Several, but not all of them, are tortured until they agree to sign statements that are presented to them by the cops. Those statements were used to prosecute people in this murder of a police officer from 1971 in the 70s. However, when it becomes obvious that people weren't Mirandized and the statements were made under duress, all that evidence is thrown out. So in 75, after a couple of different appearances between different judges, the district attorney from SF says, well, we don't have enough to proceed with this. We're going to forget it. Fast forward 36 years. The cops involved in the torture are re-deputized now federally. Grand jury happens to try to pressure people. Nobody cooperates. In January of 2007, they're charged. Grand jury fails to indict anybody. So it's proceeding on the basis of a complaint from the state attorney general.
What more do we need to know about this case?
One of the issues being argued about in the next couple of weeks are federal wiretaps and surveillance of telephones of Black Panther Party offices and individuals. It's being argued that the defense has a right to this because of the nature of the COINTELPRO program, the counterintelligence program of the FBI that targeted the Black Panthers. But instead, the prosecution and the federal government has come up with what they call a taint team, something that nobody has ever heard of before. And this taint team is coming into court and saying that they've gone through the wiretap evidence and none of it affects or influences any of the issues around these defendants. The second thing is that there's been this huge amount of time wasted in providing evidence and lists of witnesses and things like that to the defense. In January 06, they found these defendants, whether they were locked up or not, and swabbed them for DNA, and then they claimed that they had new DNA evidence. A year and a half later, it turns out in a court hearing that while they have new DNA, none of the DNA matches any of the defendants. They claim that they've got a murder weapon that they bought on eBay, and months later, after having sent it to Quantico, where the FBI headquarters are, they come back and the results are that, in fact, the weapon doesn't match anything in the case. And then they talk about fingerprints and all this other stuff, but the reality is the case relies on statements made under torture in 1973, which is not new. I mean, that's what they had in 1973, 4, and 5, and that stuff got tossed.
All right, well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Claude Marks of the San Francisco 8 Defense Committee. This is Jeff Watlin reporting for KBOO News.
The U.S. Justice Department has released a report stating that DNA collection laws, meant to protect civil liberties, cause delays in their analyses. In response, the American Civil Liberties Union reiterated its view that laws seeking to collect DNA samples from people not yet convicted of a crime are unconstitutional and problematic. Many states have conducted their own assessments on the effectiveness of DNA analysis. The Illinois State Auditor recently found that over a recent five-year period, the backlog in Illinois crime labs tripled, leading to an inability to arrest suspects. Larry Frankel is the ACLU's state legislative counsel.
They're taking DNA upon arrest. Although the statistical information presented shows a reduction in the backlog, it is important to recognize that the backlog fluctuates due primarily to the expansion of state DNA collections. The DNA backlog that has developed and which has been resolved in part is being aggravated at the same time because many states are expanding their laws with regard to collecting DNA, and not just collecting it from people convicted, but also collecting it from people when they're arrested, before they've been found guilty. This has been found in a number of states, such as Texas, California, New York, Michigan, Illinois, to contribute to the backlog rather than try and really help resolve the backlog so that justice can be served.
That was ACLU State Legislative Counsel Larry Frankel speaking on the over-reliance of DNA evidence by state and federal agencies.
The newspaper, the Dallas Examiner, is the third U.S. daily newspaper to reintroduce the story of Seymour Hersh's revelations of former Vice President Cheney's secret CIA group. The New York Times first mentioned the existence of the Joint Special Operations Command, but did not expand on its mission or its director. The Minnesota Post was another paper which reported the story and noted that Cheney's team was going into countries, finding people on their list, and executing them. Hersh called it an executive assassination ring and said that it reported directly to Cheney with no oversight from Congress. Beyond the three isolated news items, no major outlet has picked up the story, leading the Dallas paper to ask if there could be powerful people who don't want the public to know about Cheney's secret assassination ring.
Today, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, known as ADC, filed multiple complaints with the U.S. Department of the Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service. The complaints request investigations into the actions of several organizations claiming tax-exempt status under Section 501(c)(3) of the U.S. Tax Code. The ADC alleges that these organizations are using assets and income in direct violation of their addressed purpose, and that they are actually raising funds for the development of settlements in the occupied West Bank. Construction of settlements in occupied territory is illegal under international humanitarian law. The use of tax-exempt status to raise funds for construction of settlements in occupied territory is illegal under U.S. law. These actions also violate U.S. policy toward the Arab-Israeli conflict, which states that settlement expansion and construction must stop. Every American administration since President Carter has been critical of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently received Israeli government initiatives to expand these settlements.
According to a new poll, nearly one quarter of Israeli exporters have been affected by an international boycott of Israeli goods. The poll released Sunday in the Hebrew language business paper, The Marker, shows that 21% of Israeli exporters report being directly impacted by a boycott of Israeli products since it began in 2009. The poll was conducted by the Israeli Union of Industrialists. Businesses polled include high-tech, construction, textiles, and food products. The global call to boycott Israeli products, which began in 2005, gained traction in January 2009 after Israeli forces invaded the Gaza Strip with massive force. Some groups have called for a boycott of businesses that profit from the Israeli military occupation, but other boycott groups have called for all Israeli products to be boycotted. The activists involved in the boycott movement say that they were inspired by the model created in opposition to South African apartheid in the 1980s. They argue there are many similarities between the South African system of apartheid and the Israeli occupation. Some of the companies that are being boycotted in the campaign include Motorola, which produces fuses for the M80 series of rockets, and Caterpillar, which produces the D9 bulldozer, which has been used in the demolition of Palestinian homes.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imenc.org, for Monday, March 30th, 2009. A Palestinian woman from the Gaza Strip was reported dead on Monday midday at an Egyptian hospital. The woman sustained critical wounds during the Israeli operation Castled earlier this year. Meanwhile, a Palestinian farmer was moderately injured by Israeli troops' gunfire near the northern borders of the Gaza Strip on Monday. Doctors said the farmer was working in his land near the Khan Yunis border crossing when troops opened fire at him. Staying in Gaza, where Palestinian fighters clashed with Israeli border troops on Monday early morning at the northern Gaza-Israel borders, medics said one Palestinian fighter was moderately injured and was moved to a local hospital for treatment. No casualties among the Israeli troops were reported. In the southern West Bank, 8 Palestinian civilians were injured on Monday midday when Israeli troops attacked a nonviolent protest in the Idna village near Hebron City. The protest was organized at the village's land where Israel is building the wall. The protest was in commemoration of the 33rd anniversary of the Land Day. Palestinians and their supporters around the world are organizing protests, demonstrations, teach-ins, and actions on Land Day on Monday. Meanwhile, the grassroots Palestinian anti-apartheid wall campaign organized a week of nonviolent activities, including protests, planting of trees, and marches in different parts of the West Bank. The program started Friday and will go on through April 4th to commemorate Land Day. On March 30, 1976, Israeli military and police forces attacked nonviolent demonstration organized against wide-scale land confiscation in the town of Sakhnin in the Galilee, killing 6 Palestinian residents of Israel. At least 100 were wounded and 300 arrested by Israeli forces as well. Since then, Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as refugee camps in nearby Arab countries, declared the day to be Land Day to protest the confiscation of Palestinian land, which is still ongoing to expand the state of Israel. Thank you for joining us from occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imenc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Mount.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kendall Archer, Jeff Watland, Crystal Leahy, and Jack Lewis. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Eddie Greenlee.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Talk Radio, Joe Uris discusses the history of the relationship between Mexico and the U.S. in celebration of the birthday of the late leader Cesar Chavez. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Per Fagering speaks with an Israeli-born psychotherapist who has written about Jewish trauma, survival instinct, and paranoia. At 9:30, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, hear about Tears of Joy Theater's production of This Fabulous Bear. Also, art historian WJT talks about the impact of visual imagery on the psyche. And at 11:30 on Art Focused, host Ava Lake interviews local artist Chris Haberman about his upcoming shows. That's it, and stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Thank you, and good night.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 30th, 2009. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Out of Abogado. President Obama pressures the CEO of General Motors to resign, while pledging even more taxpayer support to the big automakers. Progressive heads of state gather in Chile ahead of this week's G20 meeting in London. And Palestinians mark Land Day as Arab leaders reiterate their proposed solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some three decades after approximately 1.7 million people lost their lives and the Khmer Rouge was deposed, the UN-backed Cambodian trial of Pol Pot's chief enforcer began in earnest today. The one-time commandant of Tuol Sleng prison, known as Doik, faces charges of crimes against humanity and war crimes. He is also charged with the murders of at least 14,000 people. Nearly all were tortured before they were executed. Despite an outstanding international arrest warrant over alleged war crimes in Darfur, Sudanese President Omar Bashir traveled to Doha to attend the Arab summit. Ula Ferawati has more.
During the summit, marked by the absence of Sudan's neighbor Egypt, Bashir criticized the UN for asking the International Criminal Court to start an investigation into possible war crimes in Darfur. The summit was a chance for Arab leaders to voice support for Bashir. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad urged the Arab leaders to express total backing for Sudan. But UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in his remarks at the summit, called the security situation in Darfur volatile. Ban Ki-moon also said he was very concerned about the decision by Sudan to expel aid agencies from the Darfur region, particularly because local authorities are not able to fulfill the humanitarian needs of the people living in Darfur. But Bashir dismissed the criticism in his speech to the opening session of the summit. He added that Sudanese authorities expelled 15 of 118 agencies who fulfilled only a small fraction of the needs of the Sudanese in Darfur. Meanwhile, Bashir called on Arab leaders for more support.
We should issue strong and clear decisions rejecting this arrest decision and demanding those who fabricated it to annul it.
I am Ola Farawati, reporting for Free Speech, Radio News.
A military court at a U.S. base in Germany today convicted and sentenced a second American soldier for the murders of four Iraqi detainees in 2007 in Baghdad. Cinnamon Nepard reports from Germany.
27-year-old Sergeant Joseph Mayo pleaded guilty to charges of premeditated murder and conspiracy to commit premeditated murder. Sergeant Mayo was sentenced today to 35 years in prison and will be eligible for parole in 10 years. He will also be dishonorably discharged. The four Iraqis were bound, blindfolded, and shot in the back of the head, and their bodies were thrown into a canal in Baghdad. They had been implicated, but not charged, in an earlier attack on the unit. Mayo told the court that he was acting in the best interests of his fellow soldiers, who were increasingly frustrated and fearful over such attacks. Mayo is one of seven soldiers implicated and one of three non-commissioned officers to be tried for the murders. In February, Sergeant Michael Lee was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole, while Master Sergeant John E. Hatley, the most senior soldier accused of involvement, is scheduled to stand trial for murder on the 13th of April. Cinnamon Nippard, Free Speech Radio News.
In Britain, five political activists have been arrested ahead of the G20 summit in London this week. From London, Naomi Fowler.
Police say the five people they've arrested are aged between 16 and 25 and are being held under counter-terrorism powers. In a raid on a house in southwest England, they say they discovered imitation weapons, including a replica of an AK-47 Kalashnikov assault rifle and explosive fireworks. They also seized what they call political literature, believed to include anarchist and anti-capitalist publications. Police are mounting a huge security operation to protect the G20 world leaders meeting in London this week, where they'll discuss the global financial situation. Campaigners of all kinds are predicting the largest and most significant mobilisations in central London for a decade. Naomi Fowler, SSRN, London.
According to North Korean state media, two U.S. journalists who were detained March 17th along the border with China will be tried for illegal entry. Further, the Korean Central News Agency says that suspected hostile acts by the reporters has been confirmed by evidence and their statements. The announcement comes as relations with the United States are strained by North Korea's expected launch in coming days of what they say is a communications satellite headed for orbit, but the U.S. believes is a long-range missile. The U.S. is sending two destroyers to the region that are capable of intercepting missile fire, but the White House says there are no plans to respond unless any part of the missile appears headed for U.S. territory. And President Obama designated more than 2 million acres in 9 states as protected wilderness today. Obama signed into law legislation that increases wilderness protection from coast to coast. The law is a constellation of about 170 separate measures that in total represent the greatest increase in wilderness land in 25 years. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Gunmen attacked a police training center in Lahore, Pakistan today, killing at least a dozen people and holding others hostage in a day-long siege. Hundreds were in the building at the time of the attack. Rose Katamshi reads for our reporter in the region, Gabe Matthews.
At the end of the day-long siege, Pakistani officials announced that four of the attackers had been killed by security forces and others had been arrested. Rahman Malik is security advisor to the Prime Minister.
On the floor of the house,
a high-level investigation team has already been formed, which has been given 3 days' time to probe the incident. Since a number of terrorists have been arrested before, their investigation would help reach the masterminds. Apparently, the method of Monday's attack was different than that on the Sri Lankan team, but real facts will surface after the investigation.
Tasneem Noorani is a former Secretary General.
People have declared a war on Pakistan.
He sees links to the recent attack in Lahore targeting the Sri Lankan cricket team.
किसी एक ग्रुप का भी काम नहीं है क्योंकि मैं नहीं समझता कि कोई एक ग्रुप जो है
I do not believe that one organization can do such an organized attack. It must be a coalition of different organizations. The terrorists attacked the police center, where there are more than 800 people, because they aim to kill more people and destabilize the law and order situation. It is the same technique which the terrorists have used in tribal areas.
Many people gathered outside of the training center on Monday after the Pakistani army started the military operation against the attacks. Some willingly offered to fight the terrorists. Citing the proximity to the India border, some think there was coordination from inside India. Talat Hussain is senior journalist and executive director of news and current affairs with AAJ Television.
I agree that involvement of Waziristan cannot be ignored. But at the same time, foreign interests can manipulate the situation. It cannot be ignored that foreign funding plays a vital role in strengthening these terrorists. Besides all of this, it's very important to note whether capable people run our internal affairs or not. We have good institutions, but unfortunately this incident proves that Rahman Malik is not capable of being PM advisor for security affairs, because it's the greatest failure of security.
The Pakistani Inspector General of Police said it's premature to say who is behind the attack. Meanwhile, many in Pakistan are expressing concern that the government and military cannot protect them from what is becoming daily attacks. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, I'm Rose Khatabji, FSRN.
Arab heads of state gathered today in Doha for their 21st annual summit meeting to discuss a number of contentious issues facing the Middle East region, with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict topping the list. The meeting reiterates an Arab peace initiative with Israel based on a land for peace formula, while Gaza struggles to recover from devastating Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Palestinians marked Land Day, a yearly commemoration of when Israel grabbed thousands of acres of Palestinian-owned land for the construction of illegal settlements. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
This year's anniversary of Land Day in Gaza sounds different from previous years. Amidst hopes of reviving peace between Arab countries and Israel, several thousand Palestinians in the coastal enclave now live in tents after their homes were demolished during the Israeli war on Gaza. Mohammed Abid Rabbo is a displaced resident from the northern Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza. His two-story house was destroyed during the attacks.
The enemy is a malicious offender who does not abide by any resolutions or commitments in the entire world. I would like to say that the Palestinian people should retake the land and keep up their demands. The land remains our land. If we can't restore it, our sons or grandsons will retake it.
Palestinian Land Day is a symbolic occasion reflecting the Palestinian people's commitment to their occupied homeland. Meanwhile, at the Arab summit, leaders reiterated the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, which is based on the Peace for Land formula as a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel has yet to accept the initiative, which would give back Arab territories occupied in 1967. Mukhaymer Abu Saada is a university professor and political analyst in Gaza.
And I believe that the Arabs are really considering withdrawing this peace initiative if Israel does not accept it, or if Israel does not recognize such positive steps. Israel is creating new facts on the ground on a daily basis, which would make a peace settlement to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the Arab-Israeli conflict invalid and not really significant at this moment.
In 1976, Israel confiscated more than 5,000 acres of Palestinian-owned lands for settlement expansion from some Arab-Israeli towns. According to the Israeli group Peace Now, there are more than 450,000 Israeli settlers in both the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Rami Al-Mirari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Over the weekend, Chile's resort town of Viña del Mar hosted the first ever progressive governance summit to take place in Latin America. The summit began in 1999 when then-President Bill Clinton and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair brought together heads of state and high-ranking officials with affiliations to socialist, social democratic, and labor parties around the world. This year's summit was hosted by Chilean President Michelle Bachelet and attended by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, Brazilian President Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, and the U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, among others. Ahead of this week's G20 summit in London, the progressive leaders agreed to build the foundation of a new economy on the wreckage of the current economic crisis. Jorge Garretón has more from Viña del Mar.
It is time for progressive ideas to take hold over the era of laissez-faire, Chilean President Michelle Bachelet told progressive leaders. At the two-day summit, seven Latin American and European leaders, that included Vice President Joe Biden, issued a seven-point statement prioritizing people and solutions that ensure the economic crisis does not become a social recession. UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown says the economic model of the past 20 years is over.
As the old Washington consensus of that time falls apart, of the central values that underpin this, that government enabling people and empowering people with opportunity and by ensuring that they have security is the way forward. Now, express it any way we want. Opportunity and security for all, as the Democrats have done. Opportunity, community and responsibility, as we have done in Britain, fair rules, fair chances and fair say. Whichever way you look at it, these are the values that have got to underpin not only our national societies, but the global economy and global society of the future.
Speaking through a translator, Spain's Socialist Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, said it is a time for progressives to become a credible force for change.
As from progressive leadership, we must say we will reach all the institutions where we're present as governments, as political forces, to set forth our willingness for change, our commitment with the Millennium Goals, our democratization of the financial system and of the operation of the economy, and also a new era for the economy with a new energy and with a new model for the operation of energy and for environmental sustainability. That is a progressive moment.
Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden asked for patience as the Obama administration sets the course for economic recovery. The leaders agreed to reform financial institutions and coordinate action for balance and sustained recovery. The leaders also called for coordinated response to climate change, recognizing the vitality of green energy as part of economic recovery. The progressive leaders say their ideas can be a precursor for a new economic paradigm, and they plan to take their agenda to London, where the G20 nations meet later this week. Jorge Garretón, Viña del Mar, Chile.
The Inter-American Development Bank continues its 50th annual Board of Governors meeting in Medellin, Colombia. The bank is seeking a replenishment of its capital to the tune of over $150 billion. This after receiving a reprimand from U.S. legislators over its failure to account for almost $2 billion. A coalition of civil society organizations gathered at the meeting to protest the IDB's policies and practices and to demand greater transparency. One of the non-governmental organizations present at the meeting is Amazon Watch. On the line from the IDB meeting in Medellin is Amazon Watch's executive director, Atosa Soltani. Can you start off by giving some background on the Inter-American Development Bank? What was it set up to do?
The Inter-American Development Bank is a development bank that has been around for 50 years now. Its mandate has been to promote development, reduce poverty, and in the last 5 decades, it has managed to fund projects that have fallen way short of really providing development that is sustainable and have really failed to reduce poverty. In fact, the last time the IDB asked for replenishment was in 1994, and as part of that replenishment, it was given a mandate that it focus more broadly, more narrowly on reducing inequity and inequality in Latin America and in promoting sustainable development. And as we look at, 12 years later, looking at the fact that inequality has virtually not been reduced in the region. In fact, it stayed the same despite the fact that the bank's been at it for 50 years. Inequality in Latin America is worse now than it was then. And in fact, when you look at around the world, inequality in Latin America is worse than even Africa or Asia or any other region in the developing world. Overall, the bank has promoted a model of economic development that's pretty much based on natural resources exports and really is unsustainable.
You mentioned replenishments. Where does this money come from?
Well, this is an interesting thing. The IDB is made up of donor countries and borrower countries, about 46 of them around the world. The United States makes up the biggest shareholder in the IDB, controlling 30% of the IDB. In fact, U.S. Treasury dollars, in fact, our tax dollars, are funding 30% of this bank. So where the replenishment would come from, it would come from the donor countries, in which the U.S. would be a significant source. So the debate about this is going to be coming up in the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Executive branch, and will be a big topic of debate in Washington. And we hope that listeners out there are that are listening to this are able to get more engaged on this issue. And we really need to insist that our tax dollars are not destroying the planet in the name of development, when in fact most of the IDB's loans are going to projects that are mostly benefiting private sector interests, large corporations, oil companies, mining companies, and not really benefiting the region.
What's your vision of a responsible Inter-American Development Bank project?
Well, I would say the first thing I would say is to do no harm. The bank's current policies are, in fact, promoting those directly funding projects that destroy the rainforest and promoting development policies that that are actually at odds with the goals of protecting the forest. The bank needs to really question the model of export development, exploring the development model that's really based on short-term liquidation of natural resources, and stop doing that. It also needs to basically look at stopping funding any kind of funding for fossil fuel lending. With climate change on the horizon and a big topic of debate, there's a big debate here about whether any future replenishment should be conditioned on the bank getting out of fossil fuels and getting into things that policies and projects that support climate stabilization and help the region's government adapt to the changes that are going to be affected by because of climate change. And so we see that as a big debate as well.
So what comes after this meeting in Medellin?
This debate's going to be gaining momentum between now and the next year, and sometime between now and October, we expect there to be, developing countries and the donor countries will be crystallizing their proposal of what they think this capital increase should be. This is a moment for civil society. This is the moment we haven't had in 20 years for organizations that care about the environment, human rights, and development and poverty in the Americas to band together and really push back and put the kind of pressure that we saw in the World Bank in 2000, in the early part of this decade, to change the World Bank. We need that same kind of pressure on the IDB, and we need it in the next year. I invite people to look at our website, amazonwatch.org, stay involved in this campaign to reform the IDB.
Atossa Soltani, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Shannon.
Atossa Soltani is the executive director of Amazon Watch. She spoke with us today from the convention center in Medellin, Colombia, where the Inter-American Development Bank is holding its 50th annual board meeting. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. The American auto industry was the recipient of some tough love from the Obama administration. The president pressured Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, to resign amid inadequate assimilation plans. But President Obama promised another handout of taxpayer support should the car companies find themselves in need. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
President Obama is committed to ensuring that General Motors and Chrysler stay in business.
We cannot and must not, and we will not, let our auto industry simply vanish.
This commitment runs so deep, he's inserted the government into their business. The administration has determined that GM and Chrysler's plans to reorganize to become stable were inadequate. So he's giving them a second chance.
And so today I'm announcing that my administration will offer GM and Chrysler a limited additional period of time to work with creditors, unions, and other stakeholders to fundamentally restructure in a way that would justify an investment of additional taxpayer dollars.
Obama is asking the car companies to revitalize their business plans. He successfully pressured GM's CEO, Rick Wagoner, to resign. Fritz Henderson, president and chief operating officer, will take over. Obama said the company could be saved, but needs to scale down even more and rid its books of excessive debt. The U.S. government will offer assistance.
My administration will offer General Motors adequate working capital over the next 60 days. And during this time, my team will be working closely with GM to produce a better business plan.
Chrysler is in a more desperate state. Obama says the company must merge with Italian automaker Fiat to be viable. The deal must go through within 30 days. The government will provide $6 billion to help make it happen.
But if they and their stakeholders are unable to reach such an agreement, and in the absence of any other viable partnership, we will not be able to justify investing additional tax dollars to keep Chrysler in business.
Republicans on Capitol Hill have released statements saying they're disappointed that more taxpayer dollars will bail out the automakers. As Congress debates the budget this week, there is no line item for the automakers. Additional money would be added. In Obama's plan, bankruptcy is an option. Democrats and workers have opposed it, fearful that the companies would be sold and worker contracts would be dissolved. Susan Helper, economist at Case Western University in Cleveland, says bankruptcy should be on the table. She says GM bondholders, which hold GM's debt, are refusing to renegotiate the terms of the bonds, costing GM billions of dollars.
The only way to get those bondholders seriously willing to deal is to threaten them with bankruptcy, in which case they get nothing, or almost nothing.
Obama also announced the government will guarantee all GM and Chrysler car warranties. He'll also offer tax credits for car buyers until the end of the year. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
This week, America remembers Mexican-American labor leader and civil rights activist Cesar Chavez. March 31st marks what would have been his 82nd birthday. Activists in Maricopa County, Arizona, are using the occasion to voice their opposition to policies of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The sheriff's critics say his crusade to enforce federal immigration law is violating the civil rights of Maricopa County's Latino population. Evan Y. Lodge reports from Phoenix, Arizona.
Foreign service, there's true life.
Sunday evening, just before sundown, about 100 Maricopa County citizens arrived at Santa Rita Hall in downtown Phoenix. This hall is the same place where on May 11, 1972, Cesar Chavez began a 24-day hunger strike in protest of an Arizona Farm Bureau bill outlawing boycotts and strikes by farm workers. At the event, seven local activists began a hunger strike of their own, this time with the intention of bringing the resignation of controversial Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Put on by Maricopa Citizens for Safety and Accountability, or MCSA, the service highlighted the work of Cesar Chavez and also began a week of action aimed at bringing awareness to current struggles. Randy Peraz is founder of MCSA.
It's time for us to take action. We have a situation. How many more random crime victims do you want to see? How many more children want to see crying on the TV monitor because their parents are just going to stop for a tail light and they're going back to Mexico? How many more families do you want to see impacted in that way? How many more children want to see you can't go to college? How many more millions of dollars do you want in legal payouts? This sheriff now is under investigation by the Department of Justice.
Peraz went on to introduce the pastor.
So can Corinne Whitberg step forward? Corinne?
One of the pastors, 25-year-old Jason Lopez from Yuma, Arizona, that he was moved to take part in the week's events because of the passion he's seen from others.
I guess my inspiration would be the effort that people I know who have been working on this for months now, and I've been working with them to a limited capacity, you know what I mean, especially compared to them. Some of them have been doing it practically full-time for no money. They're very passionate about this, and I thought that this was a small thing I could do to help them out.
Another of the Fasters, 24-year-old Chicago native Corin Widmer, has lived in Arizona for 6 years. She's protesting the undue attention brought by the sheriff against the Latino community. She anticipates the fast being a challenge, but doesn't think it's impossible.
The first 2 days, I think, will be the most challenging thing. I think, by Wednesday and Thursday, I'll be okay.
Other events scheduled this week include gathering outside the sheriff's office with protest signs and placing repeated phone calls to the sheriff's office and county supervisor's office asking for Arpaio's resignation. Sheriff Arpaio has repeatedly denied any abuses by his agency and said he welcomes the civil rights investigation by the U.S. Justice Department announced earlier this month. Evan Wyloge, FSRN, Phoenix.
And that wraps it up for today's broadcast. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Kump and Vinod K. Joes. Nell Abram and Jess Burns are the headlines editors. Leanne Caldwell is the Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katopchi. Visit us online at www.fsrn.org or send us an email at comments@fsrn.org. I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Aura Bogado.
KVU is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party featured DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KVU Celeste Carey, in the MRG Foundation/KVU Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
The time is 6:02 and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344.
This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
Hello, this is Fifth Monday, KBOO Labor Radio, and we're coming to you from 90.7 FM on your dial. My name is Tim Flanagan. Lane Ponce's not here tonight, but we do have Michael Morrow in the studio. He's the Vice President for Political Education with Portland Community College Faculty Federation. And Michael's going to be a delegate with the AST convention in Sun River in the next month. And there's some exciting things going on with the economic meltdown we've had. There's a lot of concerns about how education will fare. And let me introduce Michael and have him say hello.
Hello, Tim. Good to be with you. I've been here a few times before, usually with a packed house around the table, but it's just you and I tonight. So
yeah,
we'll get to chew a little longer on each of these items.
Sounds good to me. Earlier today, I was talking to Mark Schwebke. He's AFT Oregon president. And he mentioned that there will be some interesting resolutions offered this year at the convention. They're going to talk about free choice, of course, but also they're going to talk about boycotting corporations who've been lobbying against working people and the Free Choice Act, sometimes with funds provided by taxpayers. What do you think about this lobbying effort? Do you think that's a reasonable tactic?
That's kind of a leading question. Obviously, if I'm paying taxes that are going to bail out corporations that have not been doing an adequate job and can't keep their bottom line out of the red, and then they're taking my tax dollars and using them to lobby against the Employee Free Choice Act as a good union member and a decent human being, I'm thinking that's maybe not a good use of my bailout dollars, which in some ways I'm happy to do. We just heard today that the president of GM was asked to step down and was willing to do that. He apparently is a 31-year employee of the company, and along the way, GM has made some less than wise decisions, not putting as much attention and energy as they could into automobiles that folks wanted to buy when the gas prices went up, and putting a lot of energy into things like Hummers. So, again, this is another case of our tax dollars being used, this time wisely, to bail out an industry that employs a whole lot of Americans and union Americans.
Well, at least at GM, the man stepping down, rather than taking a multi-billion dollar bonus for failure like they're doing on Wall Street.
But no, he's just getting a $20 million severance package.
Well,
they're calling it something else.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me a great deal.
Yeah.
Now, in this economic crisis, I know you've done your homework because you're going to be a delegate at the convention, a voting delegate. And we're going to have to figure how teachers and other public employees can bargain with institutional administrations in this environment. Should we be cutting teachers or should we be cutting administration? What are the options and what can we do?
Again, he lobs a softball. This is, it could not be more timely for me to be discussing this because I'm on the bargaining team.
Yes.
We are, Portland Community College has two federations, both members of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. One is faculty and academic professionals. I'm an academic professional. I coordinate programs in the college, and I also am a part-time instructor for the college. The other federation is classified, and these two comprise, between them, over 2,000 employees at the college. And we are bargaining the same time this year, the same bargaining year. So that's the background piece. The interesting piece, and I couldn't help but reflect on, it's a cliche now, but it's a useful cliche. The Chinese pictograph for crisis is a combination of danger and opportunity. Mm-hmm. They put those two pictographs together to create crisis. We clearly, and how bad it is depends upon how much information or how little information you have and what your perspective is. We are clearly in an economic, a difficult economic situation. Portland Community College, because of some real solid management and budgeting, is not in as bad a position as the other community colleges are statewide. Some of our sister institutions are in really bad shape and are in the process of fairly significant tuition hikes this term, spring term, continuing those into summer. We were able to get through the current crisis without raising tuition and without laying anyone off. What will happen July 1 is still up in the air. And that's the climate that we are having to bargain our next 2 to 4 years with. So, of course, the bottom line here will be what the state economic forecast looks like in May, because that will inform what the state legislature does, and the state legislature will put on the table as much or as little as they can for K-12, for our community colleges, and for the OUS, for our higher education folks. And approximately 45% of PCC's operating budget comes from the state. So what we're going to look like for the next 2 years will depend upon what the forecast looks like.
Well, I think all of our listeners understand that there's only so many pieces in the pie, and it's up to the legislature to give us the money to work with. And if there's a smaller pie, there's going to be smaller pieces. But there are priorities that can be considered in making these cuts. Do you think there is some administrative redundancy, particularly in the PCC system? We have several campuses and several...
You know, it's a pity I've gotten too old to play slow-pitch softball, because you just keep lobbing these babies up, don't you? It's this is difficult, because I know a lot of administrators, and they're all good people, and most of them do a really fine job. I think what I will say is this. I believe that our president, Preston Pulliams, is doing a good job, and will be if serious cuts, and we might even need to call them draconian cuts, because if what I'm hearing from the state legislators that I work with is accurate, we could be looking at you know, up to 20 or 25% cuts from the state over the next biennium. That, you know, those are huge dollars, and we can't dump those on the back of our students by doing what we did in the early 2000s and seriously raising tuition. A quick interesting aside, PCC's enrollment this term, spring term 09, is up well over 25% over spring a year ago, and it could be 25%. It is looking like a huge percentage of the folks who have lost their jobs. And as everyone is aware, unemployment in Oregon has doubled in the last year. A good percentage of those folks are going back to school. I've heard similar numbers from PSU. So what we're having is a lot of people come through our doors, and if we are to serve them, you know, the first lines of service are the workers they see, the classified workers they see when they come in,
yeah,
and then whoever is standing in front of them in front of the classroom. But to come back, let me just finish the thought. I think President Pulliams is someone who is going to take everyone's perspective on this, and I have talked to many faculty and academic professionals, and all of them, literally to a person, have said if serious cuts need to happen, what we want to do is look at spreading the pain. There are two ways to deal with this. One way is to make deep, narrow cuts, that is potentially by cutting entire departments, by laying off the folks who work in those departments and holding other departments pretty much harmless is a difficult word in these times. The other way to do it is to try and spread as much as possible the cuts over a large number of people, minimizing the actual job loss. Everyone I talked to at the college has said, you know, we all want to step up. We all want to do as much as we can so that people don't lose their jobs. And I think that's the discussion that's going to happen over the next couple of months, and it's going to impact what we do in bargaining.
Yeah, and those people coming to the college for training and retraining, that is a vital part of restarting our economy. If they're going to train for new jobs, they're going to have to do it somewhere, and our community colleges are a vital link in the system.
It is, and it's all not doom and gloom. You know, one of the things I say thank you for every morning, and I say thank you for a whole lot of things, one of them not reading my name in the obituaries, but one of the things I say thank you for is that we have, I believe, a president who understands the problem and is attempting to address that by putting, you know, dollars on the table. And we can argue about where the dollars are coming from and how the Chinese are going to bail us out, but the bottom line is we need to keep the engine of this country running. And arguing about, you know, whose name is on the gas pump is sort of self-defeating at this point. I believe that President Obama understands this. We have stabilization money that will be coming down very, very quickly to backfill for this quarter, for these last two quarters. Included in that, as well as stimulus package money, which is different money, but coming down for the next couple of years, is significant dollar increases in workforce development. And workforce development, of course, is one of the major tasks that community colleges have taken on in the last decade. So hopefully we will be able, in an efficient, effective way, to retrain and educate folks who have lost their jobs and are coming through the door saying, help me out here. You know, I need some new skills. I need to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
You know, as we talk about a national level here, thinking more globally, some of our listeners might want to give us a call. And they can call in at the studio line, 503-231-8187, right here at 90.7 FM Cable Labor Radio. And we can talk about these things at a national level. It is critical that we do now have a president who can at least discuss these issues with the people on a rational basis. And there are some who say that investing in education right now at this time is a matter of national security. Do you see that as a viable argument?
You know, I don't understand a lot of what goes on in Washington, D.C. I don't understand why the party that's out of power is doing everything they can to try and prevent the economic recovery, as Mr. Obama is framing it. Well, one of the most bizarre statements I heard was from a congressman, Eric Cantor, who's the number two Republican in the House, who, when they were putting the stimulus package together, actually said, I don't know what education has to do with economic recovery. And that literally, you know, if I wore a hat, it would have been knocked off.
Oh.
The very idea that an educated population is not related to a successful economy is something that's very difficult for me to wrap my head around. But that seems to be the perspective that these folks have taken as they do everything they can to try and undermine the recovery of this nation, the economic recovery of this nation. And a simple fact is, an educated population, educated people, and educated population are folks who invent things, who design things. I often tell my students when I'm talking about the value of education, you know, Bill Gates didn't get to be a gazillionaire because there are a lot of stupid people in Seattle. Bill Gates got to be worth $80 billion because he was smart enough to hire a whole lot of very well-educated people who could put Microsoft on the charts and move it all the way up the charts and knock people's socks off. I mean, we see students from other countries coming to America, and I work with a lot of them, to get an education and go back home and be successful back home. A lot of those students work very hard, and they're very good at it, and their countries understand the importance of having an educated population. So it's interesting that foreign countries have figured this out. I mean, the Chinese, who are cleaning our clocks economically, and the Japanese, and Hong Kong, and even India, they're sending their folks here to get educated so they can go home and they can create a successful economy. And for us to provide that as a service and not educate our own people to revitalize the American economy seems very short-sighted to me.
It's difficult to come up with a viable argument against education. The cornerstone of our democracy is an educated population.
Unless, of course, what you're thinking you might do is create an entire nation where everyone works at Walmart. So you don't need a bachelor's and a master's and high-level thinking to be able to stand at the door at Walmart and say, welcome to Walmart. If what some people are looking at is a drive to the bottom for the American working person, where we are making as little as possible so that those who own the companies can do very, very well, then maybe it is important that we ramp back on education. Because if we're all working at Walmart, don't need a degree for that.
Well, when you head in that direction, there are even more fatal visions. An economy based on endless war and corporate welfare. We need bodies more than we need educated students. And that's a sad thought, but it reflects the philosophy that was in play for the past 8 years. Hopefully we're turning that around now.
And you know, you can walk into any room full of people and pose the question, do you think education is important? And I dare say that there would not be anyone in that room who would argue against that. I mean, this has been the American dream since my dad came home from fighting in the Pacific in 1945 with the GI Bill, which was America's first and in some ways perhaps best attempt at providing funding to higher educate a large number of people. And that, the GI Bill that my dad and millions of others used in the 40s and 50s, you know, created this nation, created the middle class, created an educated class, took us from 2 or 3% with college degrees in the 30s and 40s to 20 and 25% in the 50s and 60s and took us to, you know, the greatest period of prosperity and growth this nation had ever saw in the 1950s and 1960s. It fueled that. And for those with vision to see how we can do that again, how we can with things like increased Pell Grants to allow more of our students to walk through our door at PCC and colleges across the country, to create that next wave of highly educated working people who are going to go out and repeat the 50s and 60s in the 2010s. The alternative to that, I can't even consider.
Well, there are, even with all of the despair and going across the nation with our economic dilemma, there are reasons for hope, and one of those reasons is the man sitting in the White House. He has promised, among other things, to back the Free Choice Act, and the Free Choice Act has to do with empowering workers somewhere along the lines of FDR's empowering of workers that led us to become the most effective economy in the world. What are your feelings on the Free Choice Act? Some people say it takes away the secret ballot. What do you think about that?
Well, you can probably address better than I can the practicalities of the Free Choice Act and what it does. What it does is it gives working people who now, in a fairly significant majority when polled, say that if they had the opportunity, they would strongly consider having a union in their workplace. I just mentioned the success, economic success of the 1950s. That was the peak of polling when people felt positively about unions. The positive feeling about unions in the 50s ran at 70%. Negative ran below 20%. That's a recent Gallup poll that's comparing today's numbers with the 1950s. That was also a time when, in the private sector, union membership was in the high 20s and pushing 30%. What happened then in the 60s and beyond was we had a well-funded, well-planned, very successful campaign to demonize unions in this country. There were some things, obviously, that a few unions did that made it easy for that demonization to occur. Do the name Jimmy Hoffa ring a bell? So it became easy for a lot of folks to begin to use unions to scapegoat. And then what we saw was a steady decline from the 50s to today in private sector unionization that fell from 27, 28, 29% to below 10% today in the private sector. One of the areas where they are very strong and are under huge attack now is United Auto Workers, UAW, the folks who make our cars in this country. At the same time, what we also saw was a huge growth in union membership in the public sector. That was when teachers' unions, like the one I belong to, AFT, and the one my wife belongs to, the NEA, National Education Association, those exploded, and membership in those two organizations now approaches 5 million. SEIU took off, AFSCME took off, so public workers decided that they wanted to unionize. And for those with long memories, you remember back two generations ago, public school teachers made lousy wages, just awful wages. And, in fact, police made very poor wages. My dad was a cop in L.A. in the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. And this was back when police officers made very little. Firefighters made very little. And those are all professions that over the last 35 to 40 years have unionized. And now they are teaching and law enforcement and firefighting are decently paid occupations because they are majority union occupations. And what we know easily from statistics is that in states where unions exist, people who work jobs in those states make on average 30% more than the person doing the same job in states where it's difficult to unionize.
And this decline in our unions was not a coincidence. It was a well-funded, well-orchestrated campaign against working Americans by corporate structures.
Well, and if you, in fact, want to maximize your profits and you are in the private sector, there's only really one, well, there are two ways to do that. One is you can cut costs or you can raise prices. And if we're a truly competitive capitalist country, raising prices is problematic. So cutting costs is where you want to look. So how do you do that? You keep wages down as much as possible. So for someone, you know, looking from the outside 40 years ago saying, all right, we want to maximize our profits over the next 40 to 50 years, how do we do that? Well, we depress wages. And in fact, that's what happens if you pay attention to wages. After inflation, wages for working Americans have been flat as a pancake for the last 35 years. And that's why, you know, one of the reasons we've gotten into the economic trouble we have is that people have not seen wage increases that allowed them to continue their purchases. We've been taught to purchase, but we haven't had the money to do that, so we've done it on credit. We've done it using, you know, the equity in our homes to buy things. So we refinanced our homes to the hilt so that we can keep buying things like, well, non-necessaries like Hummers, but even necessaries like Priuses. You know, few of us can pay cash for that, so we borrow the money to do that. Makes it tough when your wages are flat. So one of the things, obviously, that corporate America has been really good at is talking to employees in the private sector who they're, you know, they're taking away another piece of their health care, and they don't want the employees angry at them, so they point at people in the public sector who have decent benefits, who have good health care, and they say, whoa, look at those people. That's bad. That's wrong. They have more than you. So private sector people get very excited and say, well, gosh, you shouldn't have more than us. I agree with them. We shouldn't have more than people in the private sector. Everybody who works in this country ought to have a decent wage and ought to have decent health care and ought to have decent retirement. And, you know, in a way that we've been able to do that is by joining together at work and telling managers that, you know, that we deserve this. We work hard for it, and by gosh, we deserve a piece of the pie.
Okay. And, you know, if we're going to make these free choices to join together in solidarity to raise the level of our subsistence, to make the future better for our children, we're going to have to make unions stronger. And in that regard, community college instructors and secondary school teachers are the real cutting edge for social change in America, because this is where people learn how to get things done and how to organize. You talked about the NEA and the OEA, the Oregon Education Association. They're having an associational meeting here in Portland in the coming month and ongoing right now.
Actually, we did that this last week.
Last week, yeah. And I was wondering if you could, in our remaining time here, give us some of the highlights of the issues that came up there. Jim Salt and or Paul Fisher may still call in or may not. They both had some previous obligations, but perhaps we can.
Jim Salt and I actually went to graduate school together in sociology at the University of Oregon way back in the 80s, and Jim is now an instructor at Lane, and I wound up at PCC.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. There has been, in higher education, there's been an ongoing challenge of people who teach as a profession perceiving themselves as people who need unions. So organizing has always been problematic. I just read today, in fact, the conference this last weekend was the higher education subgroup within the NEA. They have one. And interestingly enough, 90% of their members come from just 10 states. There are just a few states, California, New York, and a few other states that are getting fairly well organized in higher education through the NEA. You know, the issues are the same across the country. One of the things we're looking at, because in many ways higher education is a business and people have to balance their budgets, and when funding is tight from state organizations. We can't really squeeze students much harder and parents much harder. So they look at cutting costs, and one of the ways to cut costs is to use a part-time instructor rather than a full-time instructor. If you have, you know, five part-timers teaching one class each and you're not paying any benefits for them, they are much less expensive than one full-time instructor teaching five courses. So this is, as I discovered this weekend, this is problematic nationwide, community colleges and four-year schools. As a way to cut costs, they are going with what we're calling contingent or adjunct or part-time labor. So one of the issues that we're looking at, and in fact the state legislature is looking at this through one of the bills up there, is working as hard as possible to make sure that our students have access to instructors. Part-timers do a good job teaching, but students need to get to them.
Well, I thank you for your quick summary of what's going on with the NEA, and we appreciate you being here in the studio this evening. You've been quite helpful.
Pleasure, Tim. Thanks.
Driving someone else's car, the local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. A Billy fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, listening to Prison Pipeline. This is Ruth Kovach, your host. Welcome, and thank you for tuning us in. Tonight, we're going to have a good program with, as a guest, Kelly Fitzpatrick, who is part of Phoenix Rising Transitions and has a lot of interesting things to say to us. But first, Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
This is not a day or year like any other. That's because many nations are in the midst of economic recession and failure. And it is workers worldwide who are suffering from layoffs and mass firings in almost every sector of the global economy. While labor is depressed, capital is aggregating to itself bigger and larger shares of national and global wealth as governments rush to bail out banks and investment firms, but only if they are too big to fail. Under the amended rules of capitalism, corporations, especially in the financial sector, can scam, steal, and hustle virtually everyone. And when the economy tumbles and falls, the government bails them out with public monies. Under such a system, capital can never lose. But workers can, and they are. Lost jobs, foreclosed homes, families broken and shattered. This is one hell of a mayday. But it's the one that globalized capital has brought us. Only if labor is truly globalized can it fight for and demand its fair share from the ravages of capitalism. Let that be our mission for May Day and for tomorrow. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thank you, Mamiya. He always has a good message for us, and now I hope I'm going to have another good message that you're going to want to hear. I'm going to introduce to you tonight Kelly Fitzpatrick. Kelly is on the board of directors for Phoenix Rising Transition, a very fine organization which works with prisoners on a transitional program, and I think she's on the line right now. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, Ruth. How are you?
Well, I'm so glad to hear from you. I hope that we're going to share some stories that our prisoners will be listening to. We have a lot of outreach to friends, family, and loved ones of folks who have someone that's incarcerated, and they are trying to learn all they can about prison life, prisoners, and how to help them start over. And your program, Phoenix Rising Transition, is certainly a part of that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I just am so grateful that I get to talk about it in public. I just love the work that I get to do.
Well, how long have you been with Phoenix Rising Transitions?
Officially about 2 years, and then I went in a few times to the prison to do trainings the year previous to that.
Mm-hmm. So you do a lot of training. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happens when at Columbia River Correctional Institute a few Phoenix Rising Transitions folks come and visit them and have a meeting?
Yes, we some of us from the community that have not been in prison join with people who are in the community who have been in prison. And we go inside, and we go inside regularly. I go in between 2 and 4 times a month. And then weeks that I don't go inside, I work with guys outside. So at least once a week I'm doing work with cons or ex-cons. All of them at this point are men. And we do transformational trainings. We teach them how to be community organizers. It's a voluntary program. They are not required to go. They bring other convicts with them. And if they decide that it's not for them, we've got it arranged that they don't get punished for dropping out, which is quite unique. It's not a mandatory program on any level.
When you say they bring other prisoners in with them, you know, I've been going to some of these meetings, too, and I have referred to them in my conversations with this listening audience. And prisoners who know other prisoners, some are taking part in these programs, these transitional programs and other self-improvement programs that are offered inside prisons. And their other friends that they make will notice that a change comes over them. They become more tolerant of what they have to do. They become more accepting of what's ahead for them. And the friends that they make will say to them, you know, what can I do to be on the same track that you're on? And that's when they'll say, well, you can join us at Phoenix Rising Transition and take part of this program. And one of the main things that goes on at those meetings is some of the relational meetings. Now tell me, let's share with our listeners what a relational meeting is.
A relational meeting is an intentional conversation, and it is the building block of community organizing. And we use community organizing as a tool for personal transformation and for transformation of the community. And our guys come in and they learn what it's like to have a conversation that's real, it's eye to eye, and it's about important things that are going on in our own lives. And it's a conversation between equals. They know that we're in there talking to them as peers. We work specifically with career criminals, people who have decided that they prefer to be called convicts. These are the guys that have been in there for a long time.
Well, I noticed that the relational meetings that I've been a part of, the leader of the group meeting will suggest a topic for us to discuss. Can you think of a few of the topics people might be asked to discuss when they're meeting in, for about like a 15-minute visit? What would they talk about?
Sometimes they talk about their basic needs when they get out. What are the pressures that are on them and on their families? The things that they expect are going to happen. Sometimes they'll talk about what kind of recovery that they need to really focus on, making the transition from inside all the way out. And a lot of times they do really well inside and they get out and they go through an incredible culture shock. So there's a discussion about preparation for that and the reality of it and how to break the cycle of coming back into criminality, back into addictions, and what they're going to do different. So the conversations are very real. A lot of times they come in and they say, wow, it is really good to be in this room. It's the first place I found where I'm safe to just kind of let my defenses down and have a real conversation. without watching my back.
And I think it's important to know that after they're out, their connection to Phoenix Rising Transitions continues. In other words, they go to other meetings where they're helped. Isn't that true?
Yes. And what's really cool about this program is that we've got a mentoring program, and it's a triad where you've got the ex-con who comes out, and then you have what's called a cultural advisor, somebody who's been in the prison system, another ex-con who's made it successfully, and has done enough work to be prepared to mentor the guys behind him. And then we've got a community member who has never been inside except maybe to do some trainings, but who's not been an ex-con. And so it brings them out of the prison culture into the greater community, and helps them make a transition where they're not in the same little box of guys cycling in and out all the time.
Well, typically, how long does someone continue to stay in touch with Phoenix after their release?
It really is very individualized. I mean, some of the guys have stayed in touch for years, and other guys come out, and they get very involved with, you know, starting their business or getting a home, getting a girlfriend, getting a car, all of that, and they'll stay in touch until they get stable, and then they're off. And that's not a failure as far as I'm concerned. That's a win. Any guy that doesn't go back in again, that's a win.
Absolutely.
Some of them stick around, and they take their community organizing skills, their leadership skills, and they take them further into the community, and they, once they get their basic needs met, they stick around, and they not only mentor the guys behind them, but they start doing some community change and start working with other people involved in changing what's going on in Portland.
Well, basically, when I became involved in these relational meetings, I didn't quite get it, why it would be important or useful for someone who was incarcerated to have a talk with anybody from the outside and just sit and talk about things. And then I found out that I was going to be learning as much as I was teaching. And the conversation is two-way, and I might say to them, what was it that went on in your youth that got you on a path that led to a path that led to a life of crime? And then they turn around and they say to me, and Ruth, what was it in your youth that got you on the path that you do your activism, or what makes you do what you want? And I found out in these conversations, we examine our thoughts and our feelings and our motivations. And because we have to express it to some other person, all of a sudden we start to understand ourselves better. And when I found out that's what's happening to me, it was just a simple conclusion that that's what happens to them when they talk about why they do what they do and what they used to do and what they intend to do. All of a sudden it becomes clear to them and they have a plan for change.
Yeah, and that plan is called AIM. What is it that we're aiming for down the road? The first aim is usually to get off paper. And so everything that they're focused on that gets in the way of that aim has to go. And once they realize this is my aim, is to get off paper, then they're free to look at a further aim, you know, how they want to benefit their family and the community further down the road. And that's a real important piece of that. And the transformations that we get to see in the guys are incredible. I mean, somebody who's been in prison a long time could have been on the road to back into prison. Because of the support he's got, he's in school. He's going to be an alcohol and drug counselor. Another guy who said he used to sit and talk to his family and most of the time of the visit would be silent because he didn't know how to have a conversation. Well, now he's learned. And he's outside succeeding with his family and with other Phoenix members and transitioning back into the community without getting involved in criminality and addiction again. And the guys inside are shocked because this guy's having conversations. He's having conversations with larger community meetings with people from unions and churches and able to hold his own, and he's no longer looked at as the quiet guy. We have a lot of real good transformational stories that I get to see. And I love the fact that they appreciate the community coming inside. We never have enough community members to come inside. We're always looking for more that be willing to go in as equals, as peers, and not go in and try and, you know, be do-gooders, because that's not what we're doing. We're not going to go in there and try to fix these guys. We're there to have relationships and conversations and work on what are our common needs, our common goals, our common struggles, and our common solutions for what's going on around us. And it's amazing to me. Here I'm a tiny little white girl with long red hair, and I don't know what I'm doing going into prison working with Stan, except when I go in there and they ask me to tell my story and we do trainings and I talk about where I've come from, their jaws drop and they treat me with some utmost respect.
Well, you're not tiny anymore once you start to talk. You always have a very good and a very big message. What kind of people from the community go into these meetings? Are they all some sort of background in counseling? Or?
No. I think I'm probably the only counselor that I know in our organization that's going in. And the people that go in with us, a lot of them are from our larger community organizing meeting. Some of them are from different unions. That are putting together a sustainable works campaign, working on having jobs be sustainable along with sustainable renewable energy. And we're being invited to work in this area and add the piece of hiring ex-cons. And it's a project that's taken off in Washington State that's being modeled there that we're reintroducing here in Portland. And our guys are very involved in that. And they've got a relationship with the people on the outside. And then our guys on the outside are actually attending these meetings. And so the people that go in from churches, from unions, from we've had doctors go in, we've had pastors go in, we've had one of the founding members of the IAF, which is the Industrial Areas Foundation, under Saul Alinsky, one of the founding members go in and teach in the prison, and he's just amazed. He said, this is groundbreaking work that's happening inside the prisons, and it's teaching leadership skills in a way that benefits the individual and that benefits the individual in making change around them wherever they're at, and reaching further out than just their family but further out into the community to create change and accountability.
Well, I noticed that the leadership program has a series of four particular meetings and sessions. And at the first session, when it's announced, now we'll have our relationship meetings, and you pair off into two people, one who is a prisoner and one who is an outside visitor, and they have a question they're going to pursue for 15 minutes. At first, maybe the first meeting and the first week, there's a lot of mumbling and a lot of kind of leaning over and speaking in confidence and long pauses between the questions and answers. But by the end of the first meeting, when they have maybe the third relational 15-minute segment of that meeting, there it gets kind of noisy in there, and everybody's sort of talking at once, and they're kind of like reaching out to a person who's there to visit because they want to talk to that person because now they've heard the part that they take in the program. And by the last of the 4 weeks, it's just a lot of loud talking and enthusiasm, and they're really very focused on whatever the question is. And I think this is just, to me, evidence that they have learned how to communicate in a way that they had almost forgotten because of their lockdown.
Yeah, and it's amazing the gifts that these men bring. They are some of them are highly educated, some are highly self-educated, mm-hmm. Very curious men. And the men that we get are the ones that really want to do leadership and want transformation. There's one example I was amazed. There's one of the guys was telling me the stuff that I didn't know anything about, that one of the major hotel corporations nationally uses prison as their main part of their industry in, you know, manufacturing sheets and towels and stuff and taking care of them. And this convict was really clear, calling it slave labor. Mm-hmm. And yet what is surprising is that same corporation refuses to hire ex-cons. So they get a trained workforce for free, and then when that workforce is sent outside and they're trained, they refuse to hire them.
Well, so you don't always just focus on issues having to do with prison reform. You're more apt to focus on a person's personal commitment to change. And
yeah.
I would like to point
whether
out...
Whether it's the big picture or the little picture.
That's right. I'd like to point out to some of our listeners that I've heard so many times, once a criminal, always a criminal. They did a crime, let them do the time. Lock them up, throw away the key. and as if they can't change. And to me, it's important that we all start to understand that all of us can change. We all change. And do you see the change happening as you work with these men?
I do, and I come from the place where I really, truly believe that everybody is valuable and nobody is worth writing off. I understand the justified anger and rage that people have when they've gone through horrible situations and really
been victims of crime. Uh-huh.
Victims of crime, and I really, really understand that, and I have been on that end of it. And I've gotten to the point in my own work where I've gone through a transformation where I can really spot when somebody wants change. And as long as there, you know, two sets of people, people who are working and getting better and people who are working and getting worse. And in the prison, that's pretty obvious, especially when the guys are out there looking for the other guys that are working and getting better and bring them along. And those are the folks that I choose to work with.
Well, some of these men are kind of fun to get to know. You know, they start out sort of quiet, laid back, and then the next week they reach out and shake your hand, and they always remember your name.
Yes.
And then they always, at the end of the meeting, they always come up and shake our hand again and thank us as if we've done something really wonderful to give our time to go to the prison and sit and talk to them. And I feel like I'm trying very hard to humanize prisoners. I'm trying very hard to not let them be just a number because I want to present their stories to people who should be supporting prison reform and a lot of the other issues that I support. But I see that the prisoner themselves stops feeling like just a number when he gets to talk to us. Do you find that?
Oh, yes, and they're so respectful. They shake hands, they look me in the eye, they get to know me as a person. I mean, we end up having friendships. They don't allow anybody to cuss. They act like gentlemen. They get pretty rowdy, but they're always very, very cautious of the fact that we're taking time out to come in and visit them, and they're extremely grateful and appreciative. And
well, it took me quite a while to understand how effective just having someone to talk to can be, and then I started thinking about my own life and my own friendships, and I'm sure you've thought about your own. It's amazing when you meet someone new that a person either becomes someone you can talk to, and whatever you bring up, you confide in each other, you can tease each other a little, you can joke, and when bad things or tragedies come into your life, you can cry together, and you can have a real relationship. Well, that's just exactly why these are called relational meetings. We develop a relationship with the prisoners that they're able to tell us some of their good times and some of their bad times. And they're not threatened, and of course the how private the conversation is, you know, what is said there stays there, and although you and I are talking a lot about the conversations we have, anything ever told to us in confidence will never be shared with anyone, because that's what makes them so comfortable, is they feel they can confide in a person and get your reaction and just get it said, and I think that's very important too.
And then they also learn the difference between public conversations and private conversations. And a lot of what we do is public conversation and trying to figure out, okay, how do I talk about my situation in a different way than I would if I was out on the yard or if I was in a 12-step meeting? And how do we use this as information for organizing around our common needs? And then there's also the idea, too, that, and I don't know what the exact figure is, but the more outside contact, I think the figure is if there are three contacts from people outside, three visits from people outside for a convict, that dramatically reduces the recidivism rate, dramatically, just that one thing.
Right, I'm with you. I don't remember the exact number either, but I've heard many times through many sources that a person who has been in lockdown for years and never had contact with anyone else, they're not going to change because they haven't had anyone help them find new goals or identify possibilities of what's on the outside, where the contact offers them a chance to examine their life and to make plans. And one of the things that the Phoenix Rising Transition Program emphasizes is having a plan. What are you going to do when you're released?
Yes. And how are you going to get through the culture shock? I've had guys come up and say, you know, I don't know what I would have done if I didn't know that I could call you all and say, you know, how do I go shopping? How do I figure this out? How do I buy a car? How do I use a cell phone? Mm-hmm. You know, basic stuff that a lot of people know how to use. From my background, I had to learn some of this stuff, too, from a completely different situation. But the isolation I came out of, I really relate with the isolation they're coming out of, back into the community, learning how to use basic things, learn how to have basic real conversations and do things like find a job and go grocery shopping. It can be extremely overwhelming for somebody having that kind of transitional culture shock.
And some of these folks have a support team on the outside that includes family and friends and other people who have been visiting them as time goes on. But quite a few of them have no support team except Phoenix Rising Transitions.
Yes, it's true. And some of them have said, you know, if I hadn't had Phoenix, I would have been, I was in such shock and didn't expect it, even though I'd been told expected, that it hit me so much that I actually, if Phoenix hadn't been there, I would have seriously considered finding a way to get back in the prison. And that, of course, means committing a crime.
Well, some of them openly admit, I'm going to look for a way to get back into prison because it's the only life they know and they have not developed an interest or a plan for life on the outside. And just the fact that they even realize that they have a choice, they don't have to come back. They can change their life and stay out there.
And they have an opportunity through Phoenix to break that cycle, find the support that they need in order to not return.
Well, Kelly, it's sure been great talking to you. There is so much more we could say, but I want to thank you for several things. First of all, I want to thank you for the counseling and the contribution you make to Phoenix. You really have been doing a great job. I can tell when I watch you in action with the other prisoners that they like you, they trust you. And I think that just like me, you are finding that you're learning as much as they're learning. And it keeps us going. And I know I'll see you there next week and the week after. And together we can do what needs to be done. But also I really appreciate it that you took this time tonight to talk to me and help our listeners understand. And I want to make the point that if these prisoners appreciate relational meetings with you and I, who are strangers to them, they certainly would appreciate some meetings with family, friends, and loved ones. So if you know someone who's in lockdown, visit them, visit them, visit them, or call them, or write to them, or just connect in some way. But back to what I was saying, thank you for calling in tonight.
Oh, and Ruth, thank you so much. And I will see you on the inside on Wednesday night. Thank you.
That's for sure. Good night now.
Good night, Ruth.
Well, that was Kelly Fitzpatrick. You would have to meet her to appreciate what a warm, personable individual she is. And you would have to listen to some of the relationship meetings to understand how important it is when people in lockdown have someone that they can talk to. So we're running out of time, and I'm going to remind you that April 24th is Mami Abu-Jamal's birthday and reviewing his new book, Jailhouse Lawyer, and that I'll be here next week. And thank you for joining us. Thank you, KBOO, for being a free speech radio. Thank you, Rebecca, for being a very fine engineer. And thank you all for listening. Good night.
Billy Rose knew trouble like the sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. I believe he fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Down. Lulu was a Mexican, the law calls a name. that he could get some money and things to start a life. It hadn't been too very long when it seemed like everything went wrong. Didn't even have the time to find themselves a home. When his foreigner, a brown-skinned male, thrown inside a Texas jail, left the wife and baby quite alone.
Time is 7 o'clock and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Hard Knock Radio with Davey D.
KBOO has two open board seats and would like to conduct interviews with interested candidates. Those with skills in finance, nonprofit operations, and strategic planning are particularly encouraged to apply. Please call 503-516-3882 and leave a brief message with a phone number or email address at which you may be contacted. The deadline for applications is Monday, April 13th. Interviews will be conducted during the April 20th board meeting, which begins at 6 p.m.
Happy Monday. This is your community calendar for the 30th of March, 2009. The Portland Restaurant Workers Association is a community group made up of workers committed to promoting solidarity, support, and education among food service workers in our city. This evening at 7, the association will host a forum on the top 5 wage and hour violations in restaurants and how to protect your rights on the job. All are welcome to attend. Also this evening at 7, you are invited to a screening of the documentary Arid Lands. This internationally acclaimed film is about the land and people of the Columbia River Basin and the aftermath of environmental contamination and cleanup at the Hanford nuclear site. The screening will take place at First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th and Main in downtown Portland. Tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday, March 31st, the Portland State University chapters of Mecha and Las Mujeres invite you to join a demonstration and march honoring the legacy of Cesar Chavez, legendary workers' rights champion and co-founder of the United Farm Workers. The demonstration will address ongoing campaigns for comprehensive immigration reform and workers' rights in the state of Oregon and nationwide. The group will gather up at noon at Portland State University's park blocks on the corner of Park Avenue and Harrison Street, and the march will commence soon after. Portland Hearing Voices is a new community learning partnership dedicated to education around hearing voices, unusual sensory experiences, and mental diversity. Tomorrow evening, Tuesday the 31st, Hearing Voices invites you to a documentary film screening and discussion presenting different points of view on these little understood phenomena. This event is wheelchair accessible and open to the public, and it will take place at 6 p.m. in the meeting room of the Multnomah County Public Library's downtown branch located at 801 Southwest 10th Avenue at Yamhill. For more information about any of the events mentioned on the calendar, call the KBOO front desk at 503-231-8032 or check out the listings at kboo.fm/community calendar. And you have just heard the KBOO Community Calendar on 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM Columbia Gorge.